Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Take a big, deep breath. It should feel pretty good. But do you know what's going into your lungs? Especially if you're outdoors right now. Describing the air we breathe is a mission of the Lung Association's State of the Air Report Card, which measures air quality around the country, and it just came out for Ohio. And here to tell us if the Buckeye State passed or failed is Shelley Kaiser. She's Director of Advocacy for the American Lung Association of the Midland States. So, Shelley, welcome to the show, and how did we do?
Thanks. I'm glad to be here. Well, it's a kind of a mixed bag. We did good in some areas, well in some areas, and we did poorly in others. We saw improvements in particle pollution. That's one of the two air pollutants that we rank. And particle pollution, we saw an improvement. Actually, Franklin County's grade improved this year, which is great. We went from C last year to a B this year, so we saw improvement in that grade.
Okay, well, you know, just like with my kids' grades, I don't really know what that means anymore. So what does a C mean and what does a B mean?
A C means, so this year we had 2 days where there was a bad particle pollution during the 3 year period. So we saw a gradual improvement in that. We had a couple days where it was unhealthy for sensitive groups. And particle pollution is what we think of as soot. That's tiny bits of particles that are so small that you can fit many, many of them on a human hair. And what's the problem with them is that they're so small that they can bypass our body's natural defenses to sneeze or cough them up, and they can go deep into our lungs and even into our bloodstream. And that's where they can really wreak havoc on our system. They can cause basically the same problems as smoking causes. You can have heart attack, you can have an asthma attack, you can have lung cancer. It's going to send more people to the emergency room, send them to the hospital. And it's dangerous for the elderly, children, people who work outside, exercise outside, even if you have a healthy lung system. So that's why we're so serious and concerned about this air pollutant.
The report is full of this three-letter code, DNC, in place of any data for a given category. What does DNC mean?
That means they do not collect. So we collect information about counties that have monitors, but the EPA doesn't have a monitor in every county. So if that county doesn't have a monitor, it says do not collect. So sometimes they collect just for ozone, but not for particle pollution. So we report the ozone days and not the particle pollution days.
Well, that was not the case for Franklin County, however. They did not have a DNC. They had the information, and they got an F overall. We're right smack in the middle of Franklin County.
Yes.
What does this mean for us?
Well, the F was in his ozone, and what we saw across the board pretty much in Ohio and for the northeastern state is our ozone grade got worse, and that's concerning. Our ranking got a little worse, too. So we got a little worse across the board than most cities in the United States, and that's a concern for ozone. Not for particle pollution, we did better. But ozone, one of the reasons why we're getting a little worse is ozone requires some chemicals, excuse me, and then requires also heat and sunlight. So we had a really hot summer. We've been having hotter summers. And so that's going to create more ozone. But of course, we need those chemicals to create it too. So we're putting out chemicals from burning fossil fuels like power plants. Our transportation, diesel trucks, cars, SUVs, industry, and between all those emissions and that heat, we're seeing more ozone. And unfortunately, it's even going to get worse because this doesn't even include the summer of 2012. And we saw 21 bad air days warnings in 2012 as opposed to 12 in 2011. So unfortunately, we're not making progress in that. And it's something we need to be concerned about.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Shelley Kaiser. She's Director of Advocacy at the American Lung Association of Midland States. And we're talking about the Lung Association's State of the Air Report Card, which measures air quality around the country. It just came out for Ohio. Franklin County isn't doing so swell. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also post on Facebook your question or comment. emissions and heat. So one thing we know is it always gets worse in the summer, and we're just moving into that, you know how we move into it in central Ohio. It goes from 45 degrees to 89 degrees. It comes on very, very quickly.
Definitely.
And people start driving more, too. There's mm-hmm. more people traveling for vacations. They're mowing their lawns. There's all sorts of stuff going on right now.
Right. Definitely. And we're going right into that season. I'm sure we're going to see those bad air day alerts pop up soon. So that's why people need to be aware and be looking for that, especially if you have a lung disease or if you're planning on exercising outdoors, and take precautions.
Like what?
Like stay indoors during those days.
Like don't do it.
Yeah, exactly. And there's things you can do personally to try to help this air pollution, like the things you can do are, use your lawnmower in the evenings. You hear that a lot. Or get your gas in the evenings. Try to walk or ride your bike or take public transportation. There's small things that we all can do to contribute to this. The bigger things are things that are through the Clean Air Act. So there's things we've done to help this. In fact, the good news is, though we're worse, we're still so much better than when we started this report 14 years ago. So there's a silver lining. We're bad, but we're so much worse than we were many years
ago. You mean
ago.
So much better?
So much better. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yes,
just
thank
checking.
You. So much better. And so that's the silver lining. And that's because we have a strong federal law called the Clean Air Act. And that's made the polluters clean up. We've cleaned up our power plants. We have we're ranked number one for power plant pollution because we have many coal-fired power plants. So we've cleaned that up. We've also made a lot of cleanup to our diesel engines, diesel trucks, construction equipment, things like that, and transportation, all those things. So those have slowly but surely cleaned our air. So we are a lot better. But now we've kind of taken 50 steps forward and 2 steps back. So we need to keep up with that and keep moving forward.
Andrew in New Albany, you're on the air with Shelley Kaiser. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a quick comment on the placement of the monitoring systems that give us these numbers mm-hmm. and how I'm a little skeptical sometimes when I hear that places are failing, because often these, and cities fight about this, often these monitoring stations are placed near highways, near power plants, and that can give us a false high.
Mm-hmm. Shelley Kaiser, are you confident that this is being done in a way that's giving us real numbers and real answers?
Yeah, well, first of all, we at the Lung Association don't have any control over where they place those, because that's out of our jurisdiction. That's placed by EPA. But EPA does try to put these in the best possible place to get an average of where those counties' grades are. They are definitely wanting to look as good as possible, so they are highly unlikely to place it right beside the sources of pollution, and wanting to look. They definitely don't want to look really bad, and so it's not in their best interest to place it right beside a power plant.
Does an organization like the American Lung Association, though, look at the methods for this study and make sure that they're up to your standards?
Oh, definitely. And we are always looking at the EPA and how they are doing their job, and we're looking at adding new monitors all the time and making sure that this is done well, and always advocating for the best possible methods of collecting air and making sure that it's thorough and that this is good information.
Andrew?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your call. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. What do you make of the latest air report card for the state of Ohio for Franklin County? Not doing so great when it comes to the ozone issue, but better when it comes to particulate matter. This is also a hard time because of the pollen. Does that count it in the air report, too?
No, but let me make one more comment to Michael from New Albany. People are also always welcome to call the EPA at any time and speak to them about where the pollution monitor is or ask for a monitor in their area. So they're welcome to go and be an advocate for themselves and speak to them and talk to them about those questions if they have them. But no, pollen is not something that's in our report because it's not really a pollutant. But I know a lot of people are having trouble with that right now, too. So I understand and I feel for them, me included.
Where does Ohio, did you say this already, where does Ohio stand on a national scale? It's an industrial state still compared to others.
Yes.
So
we do have some of the dirtiest air. Now, if you compare Franklin County to Hamilton County, we're doing better. Cincinnati is unfortunately our dirtiest city in the state.
Should I be surprised or?
A lot of people are surprised when they hear that. They think, why Cincinnati? Unfortunately, Cincinnati sits along the Ohio River, and there's a lot of power plants that are placed along the Ohio River. So, and that power plant pollution is highly transportable. It can blow. In fact, our power plant pollution makes us not the envy of our neighbors. We a lot of times make them upset because it blows over to our eastern neighbors, and we share that with them. But so they've got a lot along there, even in other states, and it blows along there. So, for instance, like Franklin County during that three-year period had 14 ozone days. They had 37. So comparatively, they're doing a lot worse. And, Cincinnati shows up on the top 25 list. They're number 14 for ozone. They're number 10 for particle pollution.
In the country.
In the country. As opposed to Franklin County is 54th for ozone and 92nd for particle pollution. So we have those. And in particle pollution, we have six on the top 25 list, six cities. So we have a lot of issues, but we're getting better. Cleveland used to be on the top 25 for everything, and now they're only on one. So we are making progress in our state, but we still have a long ways to go.
One of the reasons why Cleveland is, doing so well is it's a Rust Belt city now. It's not the big manufacturing city it once was. Is there a way to be a big manufacturing city and have all those jobs and still achieve the kind of goals that you want to?
Yeah, I mean, we still do have a lot of industry. We still have a lot of power plants, and we're making changes in our air. There is technology right now that is making this happen. The Clean Air Act is making this happen by cleaning up diesel engines, cleaning up our power plants. So it's not all happening because the economy is going down. Because if that was true, we would kind of see a curve that matched the economy, but that's not what we're seeing. We're seeing the economy rebound and air pollution is still going down. So what's happening is mostly because of controls we've put in place. And this will continue to happen. For instance, right now the EPA is considering making gasoline cleaner and also making new tailpipe standards for cars, light trucks, and SUVs. They're taking comments on that right now. Mm-hmm. That would be incredibly important for a state like Ohio, where we have tons of transportation, tons of people.
Let me ask you, to what extent does the report take into consideration climate change? Because we talk about, particularly in the summer, the heat is adding to the problem.
Well, definitely we acknowledge that climate change makes climate change is a problem for us because of just what you're saying. If you have more heat, you're going to have more ozone because ozone doesn't happen unless you have heat and sunlight. And if you're warming up, which we've seen over these past couple summers, you're going to see more ozone. And that's exactly what this report shows.
And another issue is wildfires, of course, which are putting a lot more particulate matter, more soot in the air, too.
Right. Definitely. Ozone is not caused by wildfires, but particulate matter is caused by all the fossil fuels, plus it's caused by burning wood. So if you have a fire, you're definitely going to get tons of particulate matter. And if you are exposed to it over a short period of time, like days, that can be deadly to people. Over a long period of time, at low levels, it's deadly, but over a short period of time, like days, it can also be deadly. So fires are definitely dangerous to people's health.
Well, Shelley Kaiser, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you for having me.
Shelley Kaiser is the Director of Advocacy at the American Lung Association of Midland States. Coming up, more Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Homeport Noble on Long condominiums, offering homeownership opportunities in the King Lincoln District, featuring green design buildings within walking distance of local stores and restaurants. Details at homeportohio.org/NOBO on Long.
Examine the 68-year history of nuclear weapons Wednesday night on WOSU-TV. In My Lifetime focuses on the continuing struggle of citizens, scientists, and political leaders to reduce or eliminate the atomic threat, while others search for ways to build the weapons. Watch In My Lifetime Wednesday night at 10 on WOSU-TV.
Support 89.7 NPR News at $85 and receive the WOSU member card. The member card is good for dining and admission discounts at more than 200 member card partners in Central Ohio. Visit WOSU.org/membercard for more information. And thanks for your membership in 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Wellness Wednesday. Although researchers have made enormous strides in the fight against cancer, a cure remains elusive. But scientists have isolated certain genetic predictors of the disease. One of them hit the headlines last week when actress Angelina Jolie reported that she was a carrier of BRCA1, the breast cancer gene. Jolie elected to have a preventative double mastectomy, but a lot of women are wondering what they would do in her situation and if genetic testing is right for them. Joining us to answer some of these questions is Leah Center Jamison. She's a genetic counselor and professor of internal medicine at Ohio State University. Welcome, Leah.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So what is BRCA1? And there's a BRCA2 also. What are they?
Right. So BRCA1 and BRCA2, or BRCA1 and BRCA2, as some people call them, are two genes that everyone has, and you inherit them from your mother and your father. And they typically work in the body to sort of keep cell growth under control. But a person can be born with a typo in that process, basically, what we call a mutation that causes them to have an increased risk of developing cancer. So it doesn't mean that you're born with tumors, you just have a higher susceptibility to getting them than the average person.
Because in the case of BRCA1 or BRCA2, the cell growth is not kept under control as well.
Correct. Correct.
Does this gene exist in men too?
It does. It does. Yeah, we all have them. And when men have mutations, they have an increased risk for cancer too, but it's not nearly to the same degree as the impact is on a female with these mutations. And so men with mutations in one of these genes often have an increased risk to develop breast cancer themselves, and sometimes they don't even realize that that's a possibility for them.
Mm-hmm.
Not nearly to the degree that a woman would have an increased risk. But some studies show that there's an increased risk of developing prostate cancer, too, although that data is a little less clear. And so there are a few things that men might do differently to screen themselves, too.
Do we know what it is? Well, we know that it's not that they cause cancer. It's just that they make it so that the cell growth is not as well under control.
Right. So when a cancer forms, there are lots of genetic mistakes that sort of happen in the tumor development process. And most of those things are not born in a person. So they just happen over the time. The normal process of aging, we get damage to our DNA, mm-hmm. and that sort of increases your risk to develop tumors. And in these hereditary cases, what happens is that all of the cells that you're born with already sort of have one piece of damage to their DNA to begin with. And so they just have an increased risk of acquiring enough more damage over time to develop a tumor.
Why do they affect, why is this particularly affecting breasts, the ovaries, and so forth? Why, or prostate in men, why is it not an across-the-board higher risk for cancer?
That's a good question. And I don't know that we're sophisticated enough to know the, you know, exactly right answer to that. Mm-hmm. We know that some genes just happen to play a bigger role in different tissue types. And so there are other hereditary cancer syndromes where even though the mutations are inherited in the same way as these BRCA1 and 2 genes, they affect different organs. So there are some hereditary syndromes that, for instance, might predispose a person to getting colon and uterine cancer, for instance, or a whole other host of cancers. And so they all work just a little bit differently in the body.
A lot of times people have genetic, a workup done on their genetics when they're going to have a baby. Mm-hmm. Some people do. But BRCA1 and BRCA2, they're not included in that.
No, not typically. And actually, most professional organizations and ethical bodies don't recommend that people under the age of 18 are tested for mutations in these genes because they aren't things that typically affect children, or they don't affect medical management any time before a person reaches adulthood. And we find that it's really important for people to be able to make the decision to have the information or not, because it's not something that everyone chooses to do. And so this type of genetic testing, at least today, isn't offered to people who are sort of working up for pregnancy reasons.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It is Wellness Wednesday. And right now we're talking about those genetic predictors, the ones that became well known last week when actress Angelina Jolie reported that she was a carrier of one of them, BRCA1, the breast cancer gene. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Susan in Columbus, you wanted to talk about the cost of this particular test. Welcome to the show.
I have experience with this, Anne, I'm BRCA negative, but the test is $3,000, and the reason the test is $3,000 is that there's a medical patent on it by a company in Salt Lake. And if the patent runs out and they cannot renew it, the test will come down to a couple hundred dollars. Now, where this is relevant is the insurance companies, more often than not, will not cover it in certain circumstances. In our case, my identical twin sister had to find out if she was BRCA positive. She already had ovarian cancer. And I think it's more, by the way, informative for ovarian cancer than for even for breast cancer, because if you're BRCA positive, you have an 87% more chance of having breast cancer, a 50% chance more of having ovarian cancer, and ovarian cancer is much more detected more often in the later stage rather than the earlier stage. So this becomes even more critical
because it's a great screener,
right? And she had to find out if she qualified for a clinical trial, which I think is a really important medical reason to find out if she qualifies for a trial that would have potentially saved her life. And insurance wouldn't pay for it, and we had very good insurance. So if we were able to afford paying for it, it was a little bit of a hardship, but of course it was mm-hmm. a necessity.
Okay.
And then we found out that she was, but I think that the major problem is the cost of this, because this test should cost $200.
Okay, all right. Well, let's hear what Leah Center Jameson
and
has to say.
And the other thing is, before Leah says something, I do want to add that, as an indicator of ovarian cancer, I think it is even more essential than breast cancer because there are other ways to detect breast cancer.
Okay.
So it sounds like there were sort of multiple issues intertwined there, but to address some of them, you're absolutely right. The lab that does the testing, the only lab where we can order it clinically at this point, does hold a patent on the genes in order to do the test, and you're probably aware that this is currently being sort of put through the court system to determine if those patents are indeed lawful or not. And it does pose a conundrum for us clinically, because we don't really have any other option. So a person can't seek a second opinion from another laboratory. There's no sort of price adjustments. You know, there's no competition, so that we can't choose a different lab accordingly. And when the test methods didn't cover all or most mutations, we were kind of stuck in the sense that we couldn't choose a different lab that maybe had a better method at picking up mutations. So you're absolutely right that that does put a sort of stranglehold on things from a clinical perspective. And as far as testing people who have ovarian cancer for myriad of reasons, it's absolutely appropriate. And most insurance companies have specific guidelines, and they're all a little bit different, that they stick to determine who they will provide coverage for and who they won't for this test.
Mm-hmm.
We think it equally important for families that have breast cancer in them. And the truth is that a lot of these families who are BRCA positive have both types of cancer. So we're actually trying to sort of address both issues. But you're right, very important issues that we're dealing with daily here in clinical genetics.
Thanks a lot, Susan, for that call. Robin in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome, Robin.
How you doing this morning?
Fine, thank you.
My comment is this. I'm a cancer survivor. I was diagnosed with a very rare neck disease, and the only people that ever seemed to have it served in the Persian Gulf when I was there. But my point is this. With Angelina Jolie doing her deal, Sharon Osbourne, I think the media has gotten a little bit overblown in genderifying the whole breast cancer thing. Why is it, you know, the whole pink ribbon, the whole Stephanie Spielman deal? I think it's a bit overblown. You know, men suffer from cancer just as much as women
well,
do.
Well, right. And the second question I asked was whether or not this applied to men as well. But Leah Center Jamison, would you like to respond to that? Because it obviously there is a lot of attention given to women, breast cancer in women, and very little to men.
Right. And part of that is probably because if we're talking about breast cancer specifically, not all cancers, but breast cancer specifically is really uncommon in men. And so we don't have as many celebrity cases to draw attention to it. Or even in our families that we consider celebrities, sort of within our group that mm-hmm. have dealt with cancer over the years, even those with BRCA mutations, the risk of a man having breast cancer is still pretty low. So it's not talked about as much. Some of that's probably reasonable in the sense that not everyone is sort of at risk. But for these other cancers, and sir, I don't know what kind you've had, but you know, I think depending on sort of where you're looking for the information, I know we've done a lot with hereditary colon cancer here, and that's certainly a disease that affects men and women. And it's not really gender specific.
Thanks a lot, Robin, for the call. We appreciate it. Does when something like this happens, like Angelina Jolie bringing so much attention to the issue, do you start getting a lot of queries? What happens at your end with people wanting to know more?
You know, we do. And part of it's just this idea that it's in the public eye and people start asking questions. Like you said, you know, do I need to be tested? If I were tested, what mm-hmm. would I do? And that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is that not everyone needs this test. And we are pretty careful in our risk assessment to determine for whom this test is appropriate. We want to make sure that it's done responsibly and that the person is aware of all of the outcomes and options sort of that trickle down from the test result. But we can be reassuring in some cases, too, where it really isn't indicated. And so, you know, it's not something where we feel that everyone needs to run out and get this test right away, because it truly is something that's rare, even though it seems to be in the forefront of everyone's minds right now.
Okay, so what if it went down to $100 a pop? Then would you just have people do it just because, or particularly with the ovarian point that was made by Susan earlier, the ovarian cancer issue, if it was cheaper, would you be more willing, or would you be more apt to recommend having it done?
Well, I don't know. So, I mean, part of it is just being responsibly medically and only ordering what's medically necessary.
All right.
And the truth is, even if you took everyone with breast or ovarian cancer, only 10% of people are going to have one of the mutations in one of these genes, and those are people with cancer. And so 90% of the time, you're going to be ordering it and not having a positive result, and so it's not going to give you any more information for the family. And so we're still pretty selective, although since ovarian cancers so much less common than breast cancer in general. Sometimes just having a diagnosis of ovarian cancer, regardless of your family history, is enough to warrant this kind of test. So it's a little bit of a different spin. And certainly it would be easier for people to do if it were cheaper.
Because if you had ovarian cancer diagnosis, then you could find out if BRCA1 or BRCA2 has anything to do with it. And then that would indicate that you may have a higher risk for breast cancer as well.
Correct.
Okay.
And there have been some studies in recent years that have looked at chemotherapies targeted to people who have these mutations, and the response might be a little bit different. And so it's not used as standard clinical care at this point, but it could in the near future be used to help determine what kind of chemotherapy you might have when you're diagnosed with ovarian cancer.
If I came to you today with absolutely no other indications and said, I want this test, is there a medical ethics that comes into play where you say, no, we're not going to give you this test? I mean, can someone just deny somebody the test?
That's sort of a fine line. You know, technically, if you have unlimited resources and it was something that you felt strongly that you needed to have the test, you're certainly able to request that the test be ordered. It's unlikely if you don't have anything in your family history that it's going to be covered at all by your insurance. And we certainly wouldn't be able to vouch for medical necessity if we didn't feel that way.
Okay.
And then we would want to make sure that from an information standpoint, before you embarked on doing the test, you realize that your risk of having an inconclusive result is probably higher than having a positive or negative result in that scenario. And that actually can be more problematic in the sense that you get this result that you have no idea what to do with it.
What would an inconclusive result look like? I mean, either the genes mutated or not, right?
Well, not exactly.
Okay.
So occasionally what the lab does is they're looking for essentially a typo in your DNA code.
Okay.
And sometimes they can see a difference in your DNA code that's really subtle. And it may be the type of change that causes an increased risk for cancer, or it may just be a subtle difference that we all have as humans. We have these differences in our DNA. And occasionally there's no way, at least at that point, to determine the difference between the two. And so it makes it really difficult to use that information to make prevention decisions or to test family members because we truly don't know what it means.
And one more quick question. If you're going to go ahead and have this particular DNA test done, are there others that you typically do as well at the same time?
We usually sort of start with the most likely thing that we're thinking for the family and sort of work down a list. When we're thinking of breast and ovarian cancer in the family, we usually start with the BRCA genes, and depending on what we actually see in the family history, we might do some additional testing after that. If we're seeing a family that has primarily other cancers like colon and uterine cancer, we might start with completely different genes, not the BRCA1 and 2 genes. So it really depends on sort of looking at your entire family history three generations out and picking what the most likely thing is and going from there.
And how good are people at knowing what their history is?
We help them with that, but it varies. And some people, you know, occasionally we have people who were adopted and they have no way to know their family history. And so we sort of help with identifying the questions that need to be asked. Sometimes we track down death certificates, which are public record that might have a person's cancer diagnosis there. But we usually just use whatever information we have, and that there's a spectrum of what we get.
Well, Leah Center Jamison, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Leah Center Jamison is a genetic counselor and an assistant professor of internal medicine at Ohio State University. Coming up, we'll continue with Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jennifer Gilmore. Her new novel, The Mothers, is based on the experiences she and her husband had trying to adopt a baby. They gave up on international adoption and pursued open adoption in the U.S., but ran into all kinds of obstacles as well as a scam or two. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from On the Square Yoga, offering 45-minute midday yoga classes at 11, noon, and 1 in downtown Columbus. On the Square Yoga, located at 65 East State Street between the Ohio Theater and the Sheraton, making yoga accessible to everybody. More at onthesquareyoga.com.
Your WOSU Public Media member card benefits are now even better with the Member Card Benefit of the Month. Each month, show your member card at selected partners for extra discounts. The benefit of the month for May is the Gateway Film Center. Enjoy 2-for-1 admission all month long. Support 89.7 NPR News at the $85 level and receive the WOSU member card as your gift. Just visit WOSU.org. And thanks for your support of 89.7 NPR News. Examine the 68-year history of nuclear weapons. It's In My Lifetime, Wednesday night at 10 on WOSU-TV.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Wellness Wednesday. We've all heard about the skyrocketing costs of health care in this country, about how many people without insurance rely on the emergency room to treat routine conditions like ear infections and bronchitis. But a new study conducted by the RAND Corporation found that 4 out of 5 people who contacted a primary care doctor first were told to go directly to the ER. The report also highlights the role ER doctors play in deciding who gets admitted as an inpatient and how it's in their power to slow this costly trend. Here to illuminate it is Dr. Jay Kaplan, medical director of the study Studer Group and director of service for CEP America Emergency Physician Partners. He's also an ER doctor. Welcome to the show, Dr. Kaplan.
Thanks very much, Ann.
This report focused specifically on hospital admissions, right? Not just ER visits. So if you go to the ER because you have strep and no insurance and they send you home with antibiotics, that's not what we're talking about.
No. What this study really focused on was looking at the increased admissions from 2003 to 2009 in the United States. And what they found was that increase in admissions of the general population was almost solely due to increase in admissions through the emergency department. There was a 17% increase in admissions through the emergency department and a corresponding 10% decrease in patients being admitted from their private doctor's offices. What that seems to indicate is that primary care doctors are no longer admitting people directly for a whole host of reasons from their office, but rather if a patient calls up, and as you pointed out, 4 out of 5 times patients get referred to the emergency department, primary care doctors will say, I can't see you, we can't really handle it here in the office, go to the emergency department, and they'll do the diagnostic workup and do what's appropriate.
We have an aging population. Does it have anything to do with that? Is there any correlation there?
Oh, absolutely. There is an absolute correlation. In fact, what the study found was that the rise in admissions was not due to an increased percentage of Medicare patients being admitted. In other words, we're not taking the same patients and knee-jerk reaction admitting more of them. It's just that there are more of them. And so we are seeing older patients, more complex patients. I've been practicing emergency medicine since 1979. And in my early years, it was relatively uncommon to see patients over the age of 80. And now I would say it is uncommon that 50% of my patients are not over the age of 80.
Still, they have a relationship with their primary care doctor. They know their history. Lots of times when elderly patients are admitted to the emergency room, they don't necessarily know everything right off the top of their head. They're not very necessarily good with their history. They may not have all their medication with them. Is this protocol safer or not? What do we know about that?
Well, here's what we know. We know that the Centers for Disease Control say that 92% of patients who come to the emergency department ought to come to the emergency department. Only 8% of visits are viewed to be non-urgent. That is, that patients don't need to be seen right away.
Mm-hmm.
We also know that patients aren't very good diagnosticians themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's why the federal government, in its wisdom a number of years ago, created what they call the prudent layperson definition of an emergency, which is if a layperson thinks they have an emergency, then they've got an emergency. So patients don't know if it's indigestion, am I having a heart attack, or did I just eat something that didn't disagree with me, that didn't agree with me. For that reason, the emergency department, well, let me just say this. When I first started practicing, we called it ER, right? It was a TV show, ER,
right?
And then we said, well, we're not really an emergency room. We're now an emergency department. And I think we've even morphed yet again that no longer are we an emergency department now, that we're actually an emergency care and acute diagnostic center.
And intake.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and intake. And One of the issues that this report helps us with is with the Affordable Care Act and healthcare reform, and as you appropriately point out, the talk about the cost of healthcare and the emergency department being quote unquote the most expensive place to receive care. The general tenor on Capitol Hill has been, well, the best thing to do is to take people that don't belong in the emergency department and keep them out of the emergency department. And in fact, there are a number of states that have headed in that direction. And what this study shows is that's a little bit of a misguided focus, that what we really ought to be looking at is providing emergency departments with the resources that they need and depending upon emergency physicians to make appropriate decisions with regard to who needs to be admitted and who doesn't. And of interest is if you look at what is called an ambulatory care sensitive condition, that being heart disease, congestive heart failure, mm-hmm. or patients with chest pain with a possible heart attack, what you see is despite the rise in overall admissions, for those particular conditions, there has been a 6% drop in admissions for that particular condition. And the reason is that emergency physicians have gotten very good at creating chest pain centers and observation units and implementing risk protocols for patients who present with chest pain. And our goal is to be cost-effective practitioners.
I want to welcome to the show now Dr. Robert Griffith. He's an emergency room physician with Mount Carmel Health. Welcome to the show, Dr. Griffith.
Thank you very much, Ann.
I'm wondering, are you finding the same sort of patterns where you work, Dr. Griffith?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, I would just echo what Dr. Kaplan has mentioned.
To what extent do those critical care, the phrase is escaping me, but those first aid type of care places.
Urgent care centers.
To what extent, Dr. Griffith, do you notice any difference in your intake at the emergency level because of those?
You know, urgent care centers play a role in healthcare. It's a lower cost delivery model. Oftentimes the subtleties that we'll encounter in the emergency department may not be picked up in an urgent care center. But for things that are fairly straightforward, I need a tetanus shot, I may have strep throat, for things like that, they're very good. But honestly, we haven't seen them impact the number of patients we see in the emergency department.
Dr. Kaplan brought up the issue of resources and that the makeup of the emergency department needs to start reflecting the reality of what it actually is doing. What's happening at Mount Carmel?
Well, yeah, I think the phrase I really like that he used is that we've become an emergency care and diagnostic center, Which is absolutely true, and I think that's what we like to do for our patients and for the medical community. So, for example, if a patient comes in with a very time-dependent condition, such as a possible stroke, a possible heart attack, possible bloodstream infection, we're able to bring the resources together really quickly that if a primary care physician wanted to undertake the same kind of output or same kind of evaluation would take a week or a week and a half, we're able to get all those things done really quickly. And I would just echo Dr. Kaplan's comments. We really want to do what's safest for our patients in the most effective and efficient manner. And certainly we try our best to send patients home when it's safe for them and to make that decision to admit when they'll really benefit from inpatient care.
And Anne, if I can jump in, one of the things that we have found that profoundly affects that decision-making is whether patients have the social network and the resources to deal with their illness. If a patient has a primary care doctor that we can send them to the next day, we're much more likely to send them home than if they don't.
Right.
And what we have found is that people come to the emergency departments, number one, because they have no other access, that is, they have no primary care doctor. Primary care physicians, generally speaking, at least as I travel around the United States, we can't find primary care doctors other than in federally qualified health centers who will accept Medicaid patients.
Well, I wanted to ask about the Medicaid issue because there have been, and I guess they're trying to change it, but Medicaid protocols that required hospitalization when a Medicaid patient, not Medicaid, I'm sorry, Medicaid and or Medicare would come into the hospital to justify, you'd have to make them an inpatient to get the kind of testing done you wanted to get done, paid for.
Well, I think you may be talking about placement in a skilled nursing facility.
Okay.
So there used to be a requirement. Well, there still is a requirement that if Medicare is going to pay for some period of time in a skilled nursing facility or nursing home, you'd have to have an admission that would precede that.
In the hospital.
Yeah, you'd have to have, and that's really just, that's a payment decision made by Medicare. So the idea is the patient has to be sick enough that they required a several-day admission to the hospital before Medicare would pay for their skilled nursing facility. But going back to Dr. Kaplan's point, you know, for example, we used to admit everybody who had a blood clot in their leg. We call that a deep vein thrombosis. And we've evolved now a treatment protocol where we can treat those patients safely as an outpatient. But again, it requires what Dr. Kaplan mentioned, a relationship with the primary care physician and then the social network to be able to carry out the treatment at home.
And if I can just jump in,
sure.
What's called a three-day rule. And the three-day rule is if you have a patient who you want to put in a skilled nursing facility, they have to have a three-day hospitalization on the inpatient side. And what we've gotten very adept at doing is, and what the federal government has also forced us to do through what are called interqual criteria, is they forced us to document that this patient truly requires an inpatient admission. We admit patients to observation status when we think that they don't have to be in the hospital for an extent for more than 24 hours. Sometimes, 80% of the time we're right, 20% of the time we're not. That's the average, sort of the benchmark statistics. And when patients get held in observation status, when Medicare patients get held in observation status, Medicare doesn't pay for their hospitalization. And they end up with a much larger portion of the bill. And so sometimes we have people say, yeah, I'll come in the hospital, just don't put me in as an observation patient.
Give me some tests.
Admit me as an inpatient.
Okay.
Yeah. Or send me home.
Or send me home. And there is just one quick thing. There is a bill in Congress right now, H.R. 1179 in the House of Representatives and S. 596 in the Senate, which is a proposal to modify that three-day hospital inpatient requirement.
Because all of this doesn't sound very efficient.
Not very efficient, and in fact, when this three-day rule was created, that was in 1986, and when EMTALA was first passed, our patients have changed, and the environment has changed, And to be truly cost-effective, we'd like to have people spend maybe less than 24 hours in the hospital and then go directly to a skilled nursing facility, because that is truly the level of care that they need. And you may be aware, in the RAND report, it pointed out that patients who are treated and discharged from the emergency department have an average bill of about $920. Those who are treated and admitted, $9,200.
Big change, big difference. Doctor training, I'm wondering about whether physicians, emergency people who decide to go into emergency medicine, are, if their training is reflecting these changing demographics and these changing protocol, you know, to changing or the increase in the use of hospitalization.
Sure, because they're, this is Rob Griffith again, yeah. If they're in a residency in the United States, virtually all emergency departments, including teaching hospital residencies, are facing these same issues. So everybody's kind of being brought up to speed in these issues.
And when I first went, again, when I first went into practice, the doctors in the emergency department were ENT doctors and plastic surgeons and internists who were waiting for their practices to build.
Mm-hmm.
And now the gold standard really is emergency medicine residency trained, board certified in the specialty of emergency medicine. And I can tell you that in our residency training programs, we are emphasizing acute diagnostic skill and decision-making, and making our doctors very aware of issues of cost and hospital admission and hospital readmission, and looking at consistency of practice and trying to minimize, for example, we've had a big push on minimizing CAT scans in children because of radiation exposure, those kinds of issues.
Dr. Griffith, are you seeing the same thing at Mount Carmel?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, just going back to what Dr. Kaplan had mentioned, you know, it used to be when a patient came in and we thought they had appendicitis, we did no testing, we admitted them to the hospital.
Okay.
Right, Dr. Kaplan?
Yeah, absolutely.
We thought they were having a heart attack, we have an EKG, we'd admit them to the hospital. So everyone who practices emergency medicine now, we've all been brought really into an entirely different kind of practice where we're doing, you know, very detailed diagnostic, sometimes multi-step processes that involve treatment, too.
Yeah, all of our residents have been taught in the use of ultrasound. We might ultrasound the kid ourselves,
okay.
For example.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, Jay Kaplan. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Dr. Jay Kaplan, he's medical director of the Studer Group and director of service and operational excellence for CEP America Emergency Physician Partners. And also, Dr. Robert Griffith, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Ann. It's been a real pleasure.
Dr. Griffith is an emergency room physician with Mount Carmel Health. Thanks for listening today. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.